Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, back in the saddle once again for a journey into the darkest depths of the human mind. In this episode, we're taking a look at the mysterious unsolved disappearance of 29-year-old Tyler Davis from Columbus, Ohio on February 24th, 2019. In part one, we'll assemble the events of the evening leading up to his vanishing and thereafter, so we have a clear picture of what ensued, and then, in part two, we'll throw caution to the wind and indulge some psychology that renders a symbolic narrative. This is very much a story about that which lurks below the surface, that which remains unspoken in the subtext, meaning down in the abyss of our complex emotional world. So let's lay out the explicit version of the narrative now, and then later, we'll dissect the meaning beneath. But before we begin, I'd like to address a couple of topics at hand. The first, unfortunately, is stalking. As some of you know, I have been terrorized by a stalker for quite some time, a person who is a listener of this show. I posted about this stalking on Facebook yesterday, and in typical expected fashion, the sociopath was left with no option but to deflect the truth through projection, specifically gaslighting, that would insert me in that role instead. A sociopath, however, generally has low intelligence, and so the result is that they create a curtain that veils no truth behind it. I would invite anyone listening right now to search through my phone, laptop, or any other device for any evidence that I have ever stalked or threatened any woman, and I would welcome that because, quite simply, I don't stalk people. What you would learn is that I have sent zero threatening messages to anyone, and that I also have zero fake profiles at my disposal. Every person who knows me well knows that I value being left alone, and for that reason, I extend the same courtesy. So if this person wants to be the Casey Anthony who cries wolf, I'm happy to walk her down that long hallway to where it dead ends at the truth, which is that while you won't find any evidence that I have stalked anyone, all of her devices will be littered with disingenuous profiles, interactions taking place under false pretenses, and most of all, stalking. That's the truth. It won't matter how many people you tell lies. There will still be the electronic record from multiple women who were contacted by you to say you were in love with me and heartbroken because I rejected you. That's a fact. Of course, what you didn't tell them is that I rejected you, a married woman, and warned you about making another romantic advance, but you did it anyway. At that point, I told you to go away and not come back, simply because the only way for a stalker to heal is to let go completely and permanently. There is no other solution than letting go 100%. You think that it's okay to lurk in the background and go light on the stalking, but it is not acceptable. It's like an alcoholic who switches from stalker beer to stalker light. The problem still exists. I certainly do not want a white woman I blocked, banned, and told to go away and never come back to begin contacting me with a fake profile fronted by an African immigrant who initially uses ludicrous broken English clearly not derived from their native language and suddenly, after contacting me a few times, has perfect English. If I block you on every social media platform, the idea is that I don't want to hear from you, so perhaps sending me messages through PayPal, accompanied by a dollar, to buy your way in repeatedly, is desperate. Just a thought. But here's the bottom line. While you were professing your love for me, making fake accounts, and ensuring I wouldn't be able to shake you, I was telling people how badly I wanted you to go away. All of that is part of an electronic record. Every time you professed your love for me to another woman and told her about how heartbroken you were by that rejection, that message was recorded. Likewise, every time I said, "I want this stalker to go away," was recorded too. So if there will be a strong record of your stalking, even to the extent of the incidents with other people I don't know about, and nothing of that sort exists on my end in any way, shape, or form, the conclusion here is obvious. In fact, it has been all along. You need to go away and stay away, completely and permanently. That's it. I gave you a chance to be like every other listener who is not obsessive, to not make further advances at me, and you broke that trust. It's a fact. You were given a second chance to not make me completely uncomfortable, and you thought only of yourself. So go ahead, post whatever you want and wherever you like, but just remember that you will never heal until you take my advice to go away. The path back to normal is not through me. The obsession never relents unless you let go. So please, don't listen to the podcast and don't lurk on my social media pages with fake profiles. And I assure you, if you do these things, the rage will subside. If you let go, you'll finally be free. That's it. Now, just quickly, a second order of business. As people, many of us have traits in some way that amount to marginalization in society. And while we all experience it in different ways, from race to gender to political or religious belief, the one that specifically hampers my progress is being neurodivergent. Many neurodivergent people with high intelligence are often disbelieved, disregarded, and otherwise treated as freaks for not processing information in the same way as their neurotypical peers. These issues are especially pronounced within the subject of employment, for various reasons, and what results is that people like myself who fall into this category get marginalized repetitiously and for reasons that make no sense beyond not being neurotypical. As my podcast has become increasingly sophisticated, covering the construction of behavior rather than indulging it through the perception of a dramatic lens, there are certain listeners who have fallen behind on their listening because that desire to be moved emotionally won't be fulfilled in the same way it once was. Instead, the places that were once dramatic are now more so informational, and therefore less appealing in terms of urgency. We urgently view the most dramatic material and tend to be more deliberate and dismissive of informational presentations. It's a want versus need thing. We usually go for the want. So when I cover something like Mindhunter in a series, knowing it's going to be very sophisticated and informational, I do it in hopes that this important work will be appreciated with equivalent regard to what I normally do. But in the back of my mind, realize it's going to push some people away. My whole life, I've been told to dumb it down, even after dumbing it down. So each time I indulge something like this Mindhunter series, I know a tragedy awaits. I'll do great work, but it won't be consumed by as many people, which of course is the opposite direction of your intended goal. And if I lose 20 to 30% of my audience for several weeks, it has a significant effect on my ability to survive. So when I'm beginning to drown due to this intellectual marginalization, I will kick and scream and be sure I'm seen for my suffering, because otherwise, most of the people watching from solid ground on shore will be happy to pretend I'm waving instead. It isn't the nicest approach, but marginalization of any kind is never redeemed in silence. Social justice doesn't happen in darkness. You have to speak up to be heard, and it's especially important to me because there are people afflicted by these ASD issues, yet on a much more serious basis, who suffer so badly inside and will never be able to articulate it. So I will speak for me, and to a certain extent, I will speak for them, even at the risk of annoying a few people, because it is better to fight to keep your head above water by splashing around than it is to drown in silence. By all means, call me an asshole and think of me as one, as long as I'm heard. I'm not just fighting for me here. That doesn't make me correct, not in any way. It's just what I have to do. So, as my listeners, I do hope you understand. So going back to the start of this thing, let's set the table for all that's to come. Tyler and Brittany meet in 2013, at which time Tyler is a recent college graduate working as a manager in a local fast food restaurant. He managed a Wendy's franchise prior to his disappearance, but I don't know if that was the same location in which he'd worked since leaving college. What I can say is that he seems to have remained a fast food manager moving forward from this point in 2013, which I believe is something quite relevant here. More on that later, but for now, in 2013, Brittany begins as one of Tyler's employees at the restaurant where he works. According to her, they remained, quote-unquote, really good friends for the first few years, and then, in 2016, they finally got together as a couple. It seems as though Brittany is younger than Tyler, and that perhaps she was only 17 or 18 when they initially met. She would have been nearing the end of high school, and Tyler was coming out of college, explaining the gap in experience that made him a manager and her his employee. But whatever changes being a couple brought, there was one in particular that stood out among the rest. The arrival of a child. In the latter part of 2017, Brittany gave birth to the couple's son, Aaron, who was named after Tyler's favorite NFL quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, of the Green Bay Packers. Tyler and Brittany were also married the same year. They made their home in Wilmington, Ohio, a town of nearly 13,000 residents, which is often noted as being the birthplace of the banana split. Tyler continued his fast food management career right into 2019 when he disappeared, and Brittany, who had been caring for their young son, got a part-time bartending job to assist with accommodating the financial burden of being a young family. According to Brittany, they both worked nights and were mostly homebodies who preferred video games to nightlife outside the house. Tyler frequently came home tired from his shift after 3 a.m., and the same was true for Brittany, but by all accounts, Tyler was a good father who had a very strong relationship with his son Aaron. Brittany and Tyler, again, didn't go out to have fun very often, but they made exceptions for birthdays and their anniversary. On these occasions, they'd buck the trend and indulge something fun to break the monotony of their routine. As Brittany's birthday is approaching in February 2019, the couple plans a quick trip from their home in Wilmington that will take them to Columbus, Ohio, which, according to Google, is about 1 hour and 41 minutes away, if driving. Along the way, the couple stops in Circleville, Ohio, which is infamous for being the home of the Circleville letters, a fascinating subject I covered in an earlier episode. If I remember correctly, I might have even rapped in that one, or it was like spoken word poetry or something like that. Check it out. It's at the end. Tyler's parents live in the Circleville area and have agreed to take Aaron overnight. So everybody meets at a Texas Roadhouse location for lunch, and the exchange is made. Tyler and Brittany, who are normally tied down at home with work and their son, suddenly have the whole night free to do whatever they want. Their first destination is the Hilton Hotel at Easton Town Center in Columbus, where they've booked a two-room suite that has a sitting area with a couch, leaving that living space separated from the bedroom area. Keep that in mind for later. Here they're going to hang out and wait for Tyler's friend Sean to arrive. He lives in Columbus, so he's agreed to come hang out for the night with them to celebrate Brittany's birthday. According to Brittany, she had arranged to have a few of her friends from Columbus join them, but the people in question were ultimately unable to be there, so the group planning to head out to party later that night was just her, Tyler, and Sean. Tyler worked the night before, and the couple got a late start on their drive, so they don't actually leave their lunch with Tyler's parents until maybe 3:30 or 4 p.m. By 6 p.m., they've checked into the hotel, gotten settled, and Brittany is taking a shower and getting dressed to go out. That's when Sean arrives. It might seem odd for Tyler's friend to arrive at the hotel while Tyler's wife is showering and getting dressed, but as I said, this hotel room is really a two-room suite in which the bedroom and bathroom would be segregated from the living area with the couch in some manner or another. So Sean arrives, and Brittany ultimately joins him and Tyler in the living area to hang out and watch TV for a while. To give some background, Tyler and Sean were supposedly very close friends, even to the extent that Sean had assisted in designing Brittany's wedding band when the couple got married. It's at this time that Brittany suggests they were watching, quote-unquote, some really trashy TV, but she never elaborates upon what that means. We'll talk about that later. There's never any discourse about whether or not they were drinking or using drugs inside the hotel room during this time. We only understand that they were hanging out and watching trashy TV until perhaps 8:30 p.m. when they decided to go out for the night. So, outside the doors of the Hilton Easton Town Center is, of course, Easton Town Center, a large shopping, entertainment, and dining complex that centralizes all of its attractions into what is essentially its own little neighborhood of stores. According to management at the property, it has 30 million visitors per year. And while not a concert venue for live music in February, it would be in other seasons. So this is a bustling commercial venue surrounded by residential dwellings, such as condominium developments and similar. At first, the trio simply walks around and takes in the sights, popping in and out of a few shops, before deciding to go to an establishment called Bar Louie. Tyler reportedly consumes about half of one drink at this place, according to Brittany, who also tells us that he doesn't drink mixed drinks or beer. He prefers to sip straight shots of liquor, such as vodka or tequila. Now, there isn't any explanation as to why Tyler only drank half of his drink, but at this point the group moves on to another location, Adobe Kilos, or better known as Adobe. It's here Brittany says she had three or four more drinks, and Tyler did the same. I don't know how much Sean drank in this time period, if at all, though we assume that he did. Upon leaving Adobe, Brittany makes it known she wants to go to a place called the Dollhouse, which is a gentleman's club, but since there are rarely any gentlemen in these places, we'll call it what it is, a strip club. Brittany says she had never been to this type of establishment and wanted to check it out. The Dollhouse is not located in Easton Town Center, however. It's about a 20-minute drive away. So they contact Uber for a ride, and the trio heads out for the Dollhouse. It's important to note here that Sean and Brittany both have the Uber app on their phones, but Tyler does not. Now their driver drops them off at the strip club without incident, and they go inside to have a good time. Later in the night, Brittany and Tyler decide they want to go outside to smoke cigarettes and attempt to take their drinks with them, at which point a bouncer says they can't because there's no outdoor patio. You can't just stand out in public with a drink in your hand, so if you want to exit the building to smoke, you have to leave your drink behind. Brittany, who is a bartender, acknowledges in an interview with True Crime Garage that she knew better than to leave her drink unattended anywhere, but she did it anyway, and so did Tyler. There's no explanation as to why the drinks weren't left with Sean, aside from a quick assertion that Sean was off doing his own thing. So as far as we know, Brittany and Tyler left their drinks unattended in the Dollhouse for at least the amount of time it takes to smoke a cigarette. Now, they return after smoking, get their drinks, and Brittany claims she sips from hers at that time before handing it to Tyler to watch while she goes to the ladies' room. This drink is, I believe, a Bahama Mama. Upon exiting the restroom, she notices two things. The first is that all the lights in the strip club have been flipped on, signifying that they're closing. And the second is that Brittany hears Tyler arguing with another man who turns out to be a bouncer. Hey everybody, Ryan Krause here. Have you ever heard of the concept of microdosing? My first experience with that term was in a conversation with a doctor years ago, in which he mentioned the potential benefits of using small amounts of an edible THC product as a dietary supplement to reduce the inflammation causing my back pain. Back then, however, a person might find themselves chopping a single brownie into 20 or more pieces to accommodate. But don't fear, we've come a long way since the days of stale brownies. I recently received 2 jars of microdose gummies from my sponsor, Lumi Labs. One contains real fruit gummies, nano-infused with Delta-9 THC, other cannabinoids, and strain-specific terpenes packaged in a delicious flavor called sour strawberry cookies. The other sample, an equally tasty offering called Wild Berry, offers real fruit gummies nano-infused with entry-level doses of THC and a balance of therapeutic cannabinoids and terpenes. They're both vegan, non-GMO, and gluten-free dietary supplements intended to help you perform better. Benefits include reduced pain and anxiety, creative boost, and workout and recovery, including sleep. Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, just do a quick search online or go to microdose.com and use code CCMM to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description. But again, that's microdose.com, code CCMM. Apparently, the bouncer is trying to tell Tyler and Sean to leave as the club is closing, but Tyler is trying to convey to the bouncer that he needs to wait for his wife to return, and then he can leave. So she does return at that moment, and both parties cease to argue any further, as it's obvious that Tyler was not only actually waiting for his wife, but that he truly did intend to leave once he found her. So again, as far as we know, they exit the club without incident. Once outside, Sean orders an Uber back to the hotel, and they go about waiting the 20 or 25 minutes until the vehicle arrives. It's not clear what happens during this time, aside from Brittany suggesting that, at some point during the wait, one of the dancers came out of the club and gave them a bottle of water. At some point around 3 a.m., a red Saturn View from Uber picks them up, one driven by a younger man. He drives them back to the Hilton, where they arrive at 3:18 a.m., according to Brittany's claim that she saw the time on the Saturn's dashboard clock. She also tells us that, during the ride, both Sean and Tyler had fallen asleep. To our knowledge, there was not conflict of any sort happening in the car on the ride home. If the guys were asleep, and Brittany is the only one who was awake, there doesn't exist a possibility for explicit disagreement because there is no one to argue with. That's an important element here because something is going to be wrong when they arrive, at least in the context of Tyler's perception of the events. Brittany says they arrive at 3:18 a.m., something I'm sure can be corroborated by video evidence, specifically surveillance in the parking lot of the Hilton near the entrance, as well as Uber. Now, Brittany tells us she gets out of the vehicle and wakes up Sean first. He responds immediately and also exits the Saturn. Tyler, however, is a different story. We know he worked until after 3 a.m. the previous morning, didn't get to sleep until perhaps 6 a.m. or so, and woke up around 12:30 p.m. before driving to Columbus and partying late into the night. Clearly, he's going to be exhausted, especially because he supposedly worked 6 straight nights to get the weekend off. To compound this exhaustion, Brittany says Tyler is a person who is grouchy or crabby if you try to wake him up when he's sleeping. She claims she looks to Sean in this moment that they're about to try to wake Tyler up and get him out of the car and says something like, "Okay, what do you want to do? How are we going to do this?" so they try to wake him up and get him coherent, but don't seem to have any luck for the first few minutes. The driver also seems to be getting annoyed with these drunk people, which of course is not abnormal. Lots of drunk people pass out on a long Uber ride. Now, at this point, Tyler is awake, but seemingly still incoherent, and even though they're parked directly in front of the hotel lobby at the Hilton, Brittany says that Tyler kept insisting they weren't. They weren't where they needed to be, Tyler claimed, and he subsequently refused to get out of the vehicle because, he suggested, they needed to keep going to their real destination. Brittany and Sean plead with him, using the obvious reasoning that they are literally at the hotel, right outside the door. Tyler ultimately gets out of the car, though we don't know the extent to which he was removed versus exiting of his own volition. Brittany does tell us that she took one arm and Sean took the other. So to me, sounds like there was a significant amount of involvement, physically. But again, that part seems a little unclear, and a surveillance clip law enforcement released doesn't show it. It only shows what Tyler does next. Of course, they're right in front of the lobby. The hotel entrance is lit up in bright lights. It's unmistakable. So, finally, Tyler is out of the car. In a proximity from the hotel's lobby door, Brittany describes as literally 5 feet. Yet Tyler refuses to go inside. He, once again, states that they need to keep going because they're not in the right place. And that's when he walks off. He doesn't say where he's going. It's just implied that he's headed to that place he believes they need to be, which is, ironically, the place he just left, the hotel. So, we can see the tragedy forming here. Sean then tells Brittany to go up to the hotel room and he'll take care of it. She needs to use the bathroom and then charge her phone for the purpose of trying to call Tyler, so she heads up to the room for a period relayed to us as being about 10 minutes. Sean follows Tyler, assuming Tyler will come to his senses and return. Brittany suggests that Sean and Tyler walked away together, but the surveillance video seems to show Tyler walking away alone, so my assumption would be that he was actually followed by Sean. After 10 minutes up in the hotel room, the guys haven't returned, so Brittany comes back downstairs. When she last saw Tyler, he was walking off toward some condos, away from the hotel, but now both Tyler and Sean are missing. Tyler, strangely enough, will never be caught on surveillance again throughout the complex that night. When he walks away from the hotel on video, that's the last time he's ever seen alive, to our knowledge. Again, hotel surveillance shows him walking across the parking lot at a brisk pace, away from the building, and with a posture looking like he's leaning forward off the edge of a cliff to see what's at the bottom. We can see that he seems to be intoxicated, but to what extent we don't know. He had a half drink, and I think perhaps they said a shooter as well, at the first place, 3 or 4 drinks at the second, and another 3 or 4 at the club. We also have to remember that Brittany gave him her quote-unquote pretty full drink, something coconut flavored, which I said, again, I think was a Bahama Mama, when she went to the bathroom at the dollhouse. It's possible Tyler may have consumed it and done so quickly because the lights came on at the club signaling they were closing while his wife was in the bathroom. So, we don't know. More on that when I provide my analysis. But for now, Tyler is headed across the parking lot towards some condos, away from the Hilton, something that we, as the public, know is supported by video evidence. Sean is left behind wondering what he's going to do, and so he follows. He apparently can't stop Tyler from leaving, and it's unclear where Tyler is going. It's difficult to measure Tyler's emotional state here, but he seems equally annoyed and confused. He's upset about something, but also apparently intoxicated in a way that says he's unsure what he's doing. One thing is certain. If he's leaving the place to which he's trying to go, he's headed nowhere, unless he finally realizes his mistake and backtracks to the hotel. Brittany claims Tyler isn't the type of person to walk off like that, and that he normally just steps aside to have a smoke and reconsider when he's upset. Yet this time, he can't be lured back to the hotel, even though he's in such an exhausted state. In Brittany's mind, he's just cooling off, having a smoke, and shaking off whatever is bothering him. Plus, like I said, her phone's battery was dying, and she needed to charge it. Meanwhile, she also said that when they left the club and were waiting for their Uber, Tyler mentioned that his phone's battery was getting very low as well. So at this point, they know his phone isn't going to last much longer. Worse, he's wearing only jeans and a flannel shirt to go along with some old Nikes he got 7 years ago in college. And the reason that's a problem is that the temperature dropped below 30 degrees on that cold winter night. But then he calls Brittany. It's 3:37 a.m. According to her, he apologizes and says he's just walking around the block smoking a cigarette, that he'll be right back. Video evidence after the incident seemed to support the notion that Tyler did in fact walk back at this point, or at least try to, but a closer examination of that video revealed the irony that it was really just Sean coming back alone without Tyler. They apparently are approximately the same height and body type, so what seemed a promising lead turned out to be a disappointment. But, for the purposes of our analysis later, remember that fact that Tyler and Sean look very much alike. It's going to come into play as being very important, I believe. So now, as the video shows, Sean returns and has to break the news to Brittany that Tyler would not accompany him. Brittany realizes Tyler should be back by then based upon the timing of her 3:37 a.m. call with him, and she becomes concerned. Sean reassures her that he's fine and she shouldn't worry. And then Tyler calls again, around 4:10 a.m., more than half an hour after the first call. He tells Brittany he's sorry for being late, says that he can see the hotel up ahead, and claims he's only 5 minutes away. But then he says something odd. He tells her he's walking through the woods and goes on to repeat that he's only 5 minutes away. She questions the woods part and elaborates to suggest Tyler was not an outdoorsy type of person. Rather, he was someone who would describe three trees in a circle as being woods. Satisfied that Tyler is okay and right near the hotel, Brittany gets off the phone with him and awaits his return. Yet 1 minute later, around 4:11 a.m., Tyler calls again. Brittany answers, receives about 4 seconds of silence in which she repeatedly says hello with no response, and then the call ends. She calls Tyler back, but his phone goes right to voicemail now, insinuating that the battery finally died. That's the last contact Brittany ever has with her husband, as far as we know. Brittany Davis calls Tyler every day thereafter, but there's never an answer. Yet for now, as she stands here, unable to contact him again, and wondering why, for the second time, Tyler said he would be right back and didn't make it, Sean announces that he's leaving. Brittany protests, but Sean tells her that he believes everything is fine and Tyler will be coming right back. Once Sean is gone, Brittany is left alone in the dark silence of a cold, late winter night, looking back and forth in anticipation of Tyler's return. It never happens. To this day, alive or dead, the whereabouts of Tyler Davis are unknown. So Brittany calls a friend named Harley, who tells her to stay calm and reassures her, just like Sean did. Brittany goes upstairs and talks to Harley in the hotel room on the phone for about 25 minutes while she charges her phone again, but given that Tyler doesn't return, the reassurances aren't enough to keep her complacent. She leaves the hotel, but stays on the phone with Harley as she walks around looking for Tyler, to no avail. He seems to have vanished. Brittany is about a mile from the hotel at this point, and her phone is about to die again, but Harley advises her to simply go back to the hotel and wait. Brittany does that and makes a number of calls to their friends to see if anyone has heard from Tyler. After having no luck, she contacts a friend of theirs named Adam, who lives in Columbus, and she asks him for help. Adam says he'll be there in 10 minutes and comes to drive her around looking for Tyler. Before long, the sun rises and people begin to fill the landscape. But not Tyler. Adam suggests they go back to the hotel and see if Tyler has finally returned. He hasn't. Adam wonders aloud to Brittany if Tyler walking off was precipitated by some type of disagreement or argument, and Brittany tells him no, there was nothing like that going on, and everybody was having a good time. It wasn't until they got back to the hotel in the Uber that the problem started. Adam suggests Tyler could have done something as simple as having fallen asleep on a bench due to exhaustion, but again, the temperature is below freezing. While the thought of that happening to a loved one is terrifying, what's worse is that they drove around for an hour and didn't find Tyler. And the fact that nobody else did either, once the sun had risen and crowds arrived on foot, is really strange. Unless Tyler was simply no longer in the area for whatever reason. Did he wander off, meaning outside of Easton Town Center? They didn't know. Adam then suggests Brittany should do something she fears most, calling Tyler's parents to let them know what is wrong. Tyler was supposedly close to both parents, but had an especially strong relationship with his mother, leaving Brittany hesitant to tell her the news. Brittany seems to have finally called Tyler's mom around 11 a.m., which was 90 minutes before checkout time at the hotel, according to Brittany, who tells us that that time of checkout was actually 12:30 p.m. When I did my own check online, the time was listed as noon. Either way, Tyler has been missing 7 to 8 hours in a situation in which he wasn't dressed to survive the night outside, and no authorities of any kind have been alerted to his disappearance, only his parents. In hindsight, these situations always seem more desperate than they appeared at the time, as we have the benefit of knowing the result. But for Brittany at that time, calling the cops about a 29-year-old man who had been voluntarily missing from her presence wouldn't do much good. So she calls the local jails and hospitals, thinking Tyler might have been picked up for something and was injured in some way. But she has no luck in locating him. 45 minutes later, Tyler's father arrives and walks what Brittany says amounts to about 30 miles that day, right up until dark. He checks every patch of trees that could be considered woods, but doesn't find his son. By 11:30 a.m. that morning, Tyler's mom alerts Brittany to the need to file a missing persons report, something Brittany is dreading. So the police are called, and they reportedly arrive an hour later, perhaps around 12:30 p.m. A missing persons report is filed, but the police aren't planning to do anything for 72 hours. So the next night, Brittany returns to the hotel with two friends, and they're joined by two of Tyler's employees. The group searches late into the night, though I don't know why the search occurs in darkness, as it would hinder the effectiveness. What I think is important to mention is that Sean wasn't present for this search, though Brittany says he was very active in searching and advocating for Tyler in the aftermath. Was it because he had to work early the next day? Or was he simply avoiding them? We don't know. There are definitely some questions surrounding the search. Now, the police begin their search on Tuesday, utilizing dogs to comb the local area around the hotel, which includes some forestry, ponds, and similar. One dog seems to have hit on a pond, but nothing is ever recovered from within it. Since his disappearance, Tyler has not accounted for any activity related to the couple's finances and has, in no way, given any clues that he's alive. On December 15th, 2021, a judge declared that, for all intents and purposes, Tyler Davis was dead. Since that time, nothing has challenged this notion. Whatever happened to Tyler remains unknown. Was it foul play? An accident? Or, like Brittany believes, was he sold into sexual slavery by human traffickers who picked him up off the street? We don't know. Brittany's words were, quote unquote, "I think somebody took him." But from where? And when? How did Tyler Davis accidentally avoid passing all of the surveillance cameras among the shops and other businesses located at Easton Town Center? How did his phone manage to ping over a mile away in a parking lot, specifically at Abbott Laboratories Nutritional Headquarters building? If he was abducted, or even murdered, how is there no trace of the crime? Let's answer all of those questions and more as we transition to the batshit crazy portion of the show in part two, in which we'll separate fact from fiction with a symbolic narrative. But one last note about the events leading to Tyler's disappearance. Detectives were able to recover voice evidence proving Tyler had used his phone in an effort to be directed back to the hotel. At 3:51 a.m., his voice is recorded making the following request, quote unquote, "Take me back to Easton Suites." At least one member of law enforcement has stated that it shows Tyler's intention was to return to the hotel that night. But simply from a factual standpoint, I'd counter that with the obvious inconsistency between the name of the hotel where Tyler had been staying, Hilton Easton Town Center, and the one to which he was seeking to be directed, Easton Suites. If we examine the names of the multitude of hotels in the area, what we find is that there are plenty that identify with the term suites, but the Hilton is not one of them. So as Tyler was walking away from the Hilton, we do have to consider the possibility that leaving meant he would need to stay elsewhere. We don't know if that was his intention or if he was truly attempting to get back to the hotel, but we do see a disparity between what he said and what the name of the hotel is where he was staying. So the key to understanding what he meant to do in the moment is learning why he was angry. What happened? Why did Tyler walk away? Brittany said he was mad and offered no reason why. She claims he was exhausted and confused, but also fails to offer proper justification. Why was Tyler Davis confused? Why was he angry? The story Brittany presents is one in which there are logic gaps too wide to cross on faith alone without falling into the abyss of ignorance and remaining trapped there. I mean it in the nicest way, but this story stinks of sociopathic intervention. I'm given a story about a man we're told is simply exhausted and drunk, but the implications speak about a man suffering something extraneous to those considerations that left him afraid of his wife and friend and incapable of defending himself to the extent he fled for fear of the consequences. What happened to Tyler to make him both angry at them and afraid of them? He wanted to get away, and the point of reference for that desire in Brittany's story is the hotel. But what I see is a desire to escape her and Sean. Even if Tyler believes the hotel is somewhere else and is delusional, why is he so perfectly willing to walk off toward it without his wife and friend?